the answer, that is, the envoy himself. If only he'd bring that damned ship of his down here so that we had something to show people. But as it is, he won't bring his ship down until he knows that you're acting in good faith. Am I not? Cries Upsala, fattening out like a great hobfish. Haven't I spent every hour of the past month on this business? Good faith! He expects us to believe whatever he tells us, and then doesn't trust us in return. Should he? Upsala puffs, and does not reply. He comes nearer honesty than any Orgota government official I know. Odgethany says me. To become a high officer in the serf, one must have, it seems, a certain complex form of stupidity. Gaum exemplifies it. He sees me as a Kahaitish agent attempting to lead Orgorain into a tremendous prestige loss by persuading them to believe in the hoax of the envoy from the Ecumen. He thinks that I spent my time as Prime Minister preparing this hoax. By God, I have better things to do than play Shifgrethar with scum. But that is a simplicity he is unequipped to see. Now that Yagay has apparently cast me off, Gaum thinks I must be purchasable, and so prepared to buy me out in his own curious fashion. He has watched me, or had me watched, close enough, that he knew I would be due to enter Kemmer, on Poste or Tormenvat. So he turned up last night in full Kemmer, hormone-induced, no doubt, ready to seduce me. An accidental meeting on Tienefen Street. Harth, I haven't seen you in a half month. Where have you been hiding yourself lately? Come have a cup of ale with me. He chose an alehouse next door to one of the commensal public Kemmer houses. He ordered us not ale, but life water. He meant to waste no time. After one glass, he put his hand on mine and shoved his face up close, whispering, "We didn't meet by chance. I waited for you. I crave you for my Kemmering tonight." And he called me by my given name. I did not cut his tongue out, because since I left Esther, I don't carry a knife. I told him that I intended to abstain while in exile. He cooed and muttered and held onto my hands. He was going very rapidly into full phase as a woman. Gaum is very beautiful in Kemmer, and he counted on his beauty and his sexual insistence, knowing, I suppose, that being of the Hundara, I would be unlikely to use Kemmer reduction drugs and would make a point of abstinence against the odds. He forgot that detestation is as good as any drug. I got free of his pawing, which of course was having some effect on me, and left him, suggesting that he try the public Kemmer house next door. At that he looked at me with pitiable hatred. For he was, however false his purpose, truly in Kemmer and deeply aroused. Did he really think I'd sell myself for his small change? He must think me very uneasy, which, indeed, makes me uneasy. Damn them, these unclean men. There is not one clean man among them. Odsordni, says me. This afternoon, Genli I spoke in the Hall of the 33. No audience was permitted, and no broadcast made, but Opsla later had me in and played me his own tape of the session. The envoy spoke well, with moving candor and urgency. There is an innocence in him that I have found merely foreign and foolish, yet in another moment that seeming innocence reveals a discipline of knowledge and a largeness of purpose that awes me. Through him speaks a shrewd and magnanimous people, a people who have woven together into one wisdom a profound, old, terrible, and unimaginably various experience of life. But he himself is young, impatient, inexperienced. He stands higher than we stand, seeing wider, but he is himself only the height of a man. He speaks better now than he did in Erenrung, more simply and more subtly. He has learned his job in doing it, like us all. His speech was often interrupted by members of the domination faction demanding that the president stop this lunatic, turn him out, and get on with the order of business. Commenso Yemenbe was most obstreperous, and probably spontaneous.
"You don't swallow this, Gitchy-Mitchy,"
he kept roaring across to Opsler. Planned interruptions, which made part of the tape hard to follow, were led, Opsler says, by Kaharo Sile. From memory, Alshol presiding.
"Mr. Envoy, we find this information and the proposals made by Mr. Opsler, Mr. Strasser, Mr. Ithipen, Mr. Yege, and others most interesting, most stimulating. We need, however, a little more to go on."
Laughter.
"Since the King of Karhide has the vehicle you arrived on locked up where we can't see it, would it be possible, as suggested, for you to bring down your starship? What do you call it?"
"Aye. Starship is a good name, sir."
"Alshol. Oh, what do you call it?"
"Aye. Well, technically it's a manned interstellar Cetian design NAFAL-20.
Voice. "You're sure it's not St. Pethetha's sledge?"
Laughter.
Alshol. "Please. Yes, well, if you can get this ship down under the ground here, solid ground, you might say, so that we can, as it were, have some substantial fish guts."
"Aye. I want very much to bring that ship down, Mr. Alshol, as proof and witness of our reciprocal good faith. I await only your preliminary public announcement of the event."
Kaharo Sile. "Don't you see, commensals, what all this is? It's not just a stupid joke. It is, in intention, a public mockery of our credulity, our gullibility, our stupidity, engineered with incredible impudence by this person who stands here before us today. You know he comes from Karhide. You know he is a Karhidish agent. You can see he is a sexual deviant of a type that in Karhide, due to the influence of the dark cult, is left uncured, and sometimes is even artificially created for the foreteller's orgies. And yet when he says, 'I am from outer space,' some of you actually shut your eyes, abase your intellects, and believe. Never could I have thought it possible,"
etc., etc. To judge by the tape, I withstood jibes and assaults with patience. Opsler says he handled himself well. "I was hanging about outside the hall to see them come out after the session of the 33. I had a grim, pondering look. Well, he might. My helplessness is intolerable. I was one who set this machine running, and now cannot control its running. I slink in the streets with my hood pulled forward to catch a glimpse of the envoy. For this useless, sneaking life, I threw away my power, my money, and my friends. What a fool you are, Ferrum. Why can I never set my heart on a possible thing?" Odeps, Susmi. The transmitting device Henley I has now turned over to the 33 in Opsler's care is not going to change any minds. No doubt it does what he says it does. But if Royal Mathematician Schorst would say of it only, "I don't understand the principles," then no Orgota mathematician or engineer will do much better, and nothing is proved or disproved. An admirable outcome were this world one fastness of the Hundera. But alas, we must walk forward, troubling the new snow, proving and disproving, asking and answering. Once more I pressed on Opsler the feasibility of having I radio his starship, waken the people aboard, and ask them to converse with the commensals by radio hookup to the hall of the 33. This time Opsler had a reason ready for not doing so. "Listen, Estraven, my dear, the Sarf runs all our radio. You know that by now. I have no idea, even I, which of the men in communications are the Sarf men. Most of them, no doubt, for I know, as a fact, that they run the transmitters and receivers on every level right down to the technicians and repairmen. They could and would block or falsify any transmission we received, if we did receive one. Can you imagine that scene in the hall? We outer spacers, victims of our own hoax, listening with bated breath to a clutter of static and nothing else. No answer, no message. And you have no money to hire some loyal technicians or buy off some of theirs?" I asked. But no use. He fears for his own prestige. His behavior towards me is already changed. If he calls off his reception for the envoy tonight, things are in a bad way. Odarhad Sasmi. He called off the reception. This morning I went to see the envoy, in proper Orgota style, not openly at Chuskis's house, where the staff must be crawling with Sarf agents, Chuskis being one himself, but in the street, by chance, gown fashion, sneaking and creeping. Mr. I, will you hear me a moment? He looked around, startled, and, recognizing me, alarmed. After a moment he broke out, "What good is it, Mr. Harth? You know that I can't rely on what you say, since Erin Rung—" That was candid, if not perceptive. Yet it was perceptive, too. He knew that I wanted to advise him, not to ask something of him, and spoke to save my pride. I said, "This is Mishnori, not Erin Rung. But the danger you are in is the same. If you cannot persuade Opsle Oyege to let you make radio contact with your ship, so that the people aboard it can, while remaining safe, lend some support to your statements, then I think you should use your own instrument, the Ansible, and call the ship down at once. The risk it will run is less than the risk you are now running alone." The commensal's debates concerning my messages have been kept secret. How do you know about my statements, Mr. Harf? Because I have made it my life's business to know. But it is not your business here, sir. It is up to the commensals of Ogorain. I tell you that you're in danger of your life, Mr. I said. To that he said nothing, and I left him. I should have spoken to him days ago. And it's too late. Fear undoes his mission and my hope once more. Not fear of the alien, the unearthly, not here. These Orgota have not the wits nor size of spirit to fear what is truly and immensely strange. They cannot even see it. They look at the man from another world, and see what? A spy from Karhide, a pervert, an agent, a sorry little political unit like themselves. If he does not send for the ship at once, it will be too late. It may be already too late. It is my fault. I have done nothing right.
Chapter 12. On Time and Darkness. From The Sayings of Tehulme, the High Priest, a book of the Yomesh Canon composed in North Orgorain about 900 years ago. Meshe is a center of time. That moment of his life when he saw all things clearly came when he had lived on Earth 30 years, and after it he lived on Earth again 30 years, so that the seeing befell in the center of his life. And all the ages up until the seeing were as long as the ages will be after the seeing, which befell in the center of time. And in the center there is no time past, and no time to come. In all time past, it is. In all time to come, it is. It has not been, nor yet will it be. It is. It is all. Nothing is unseen. The poor man of Shene came to Meshe lamenting that he had not food to give the child of his flesh, nor grain to sow, for the rains had rotted the seed in the ground, and all the folk of his hearth starved. Meshe said, "Dig in the stone fields of Tuerish, and you will find there is a treasure of silver and precious stones. For I see a king bury it there 10,000 years ago, when a neighboring king presses feud upon him." The poor man of Shene dug in the moraines of Tuerish, and unearthed where Meshe pointed a great hoard of ancient jewels, and at sight of it he shouted aloud for joy. But Meshe, standing by, wept at sight of it, saying, "I see a man kill his hearth-brother for one of those carven stones. That is 10,000 years from now, and the bones of the murdered man will lie in this grave where the treasure lies. O man of Shene, I know too where your grave is. I see you lying in it." The life of every man is in the center of time, for all were seen in the seeing of Meshe, and are in his eye. We, are the pupils of his eye. Our doing is his seeing. Our being is knowing. A hemin tree in the heart of Ornan Forest, which lies 100 miles long and 100 miles wide, was old and greatly grown, with 100 branches, and on every branch 1,000 twigs, and on every twig 100 leaves. The tree said in its rooted being, "All my leaves are seen but one. This one in the darkness cast by all the others. This one leaf I keep secret to myself. Who will see it in the darkness of my leaves? And who will count the number of them?" Mesha passed through the forest of Ornan in his wanderings, and from that one tree plucked that one leaf. No raindrop falls in the storms of autumn that ever fell before. And the rain has fallen, and falls, and will fall throughout all the autumns of the years. Mesha saw each drop, where it fell, and falls, and will fall. In the eye of Mesha are all the stars, and the darknesses between the stars, and all are bright. In the answering of the question of the Lord of Shorth, in the moment of the seeing, Mesha saw all the sky as if it were all one sun. Above the earth and under the earth, all the sphere of sky was bright as the sun's surface, and there was no darkness. For he saw not what was, nor what will be, but what is. The stars that flee and take away their light all were present in his eye, and all their light shone presently. This is a mystical expression of one of the theories used to support the expanding universe hypothesis first proposed by the mathematical school of Sif over 4,000 years ago and generally accepted by later cosmologists, even though meteorological conditions on Gethen prevent their gathering much observational support from astronomy. The rate of expansion, Hubble's constant, or Herrick's constant, can in fact be estimated from the observed amount of light in the night sky. The point here involved is that if the universe were not expanding, the night sky would not appear to be dark. Darkness is only in the mortal eye, that thinks it sees, but sees not. In the sight of Mesha, there is no darkness. Therefore those that call upon the darkness, the Hanarata, are made fools of and spat out from the mouth of Mesha, for they name what is not, calling it source and end. There is neither source nor end, for all things are in the center of time. As all the stars may be reflected in a round raindrop falling in the night, so too do all the stars reflect the raindrop. There is neither darkness nor death, for all things are in the light of the moment, and their end and their beginning are one. One center, one seeing, one law, one light. Look now into the eye of Mesha.
Chapter 13. Down on the Farm. Alarmed by Estravin's sudden reappearance, his familiarity with my affairs and the fierce urgency of his warnings, I hailed a taxi and drove straight to Opsles Island, meaning to ask the commensal how Estravin knew so much and why he had suddenly popped up from nowhere urging me to do precisely what Opsler yesterday had advised against doing. The commensal was out. The doorkeeper did not know where he was or when he would be in. I went to Yagay's house with no better luck. The heavy snow, the heaviest of the autumn so far, was falling. My driver refused to take me farther than to Shugis's house, as he did not have snow cleats on his tires. That evening I failed to reach Opsler, Yagay, or Sloser by telephone. At dinner, Shuskis explained. A Yomish festival was going on. The solemnity of the saints and throne upholders and high officials of the commensality were expected to be seen at the temples. He also explained Estravan's behavior, shrewdly enough as that of a man once powerful and now fallen, who grasps at any chance to influence persons or events, always less rationally, more desperately, as time passes, and he knows himself sinking into powerless anonymity. I agreed that this would explain Estravan's anxious, almost frantic manner. The anxiety had, however, infected me. I was vaguely ill at ease all through that long and heavy meal. Juskus talked and talked to me and to the many employees, aides, and sycophants who sat down at his table nightly. I had never known him so long-winded, so relentlessly jovial. When dinner was over, it was pretty late for going out again. And, in any case, the solemnity would keep all the commensals busy, Juskus said, until after midnight. I decided to pass up supper. I went to bed early. Sometime between midnight and dawn, I was awakened by strangers informed that I was under arrest and taken by an armed guard to the Kundershaden prison. Kundershaden is old, one of the few very old buildings left in Mishnori. I had noticed it often as I went about the city, a long, grimy, many-towered, ill-looking place, distinct among the pallid bulks and hulks of the commensal edifices. It is what it looks like and is called. It is a jail. It is not a front for something else, not a facade, not a pseudonym. It is real, the real thing, the thing behind the words. The guards, a sturdy, solid lot, hustled me through the corridors and left me alone in a small room, very dirty and very brightly lit. In a few minutes another lot of guards came crowding in as escort to a thin-faced man with an air of authority. He dismissed all but two. I asked him if I would be allowed to send word to Commensal Obsle. "The Commensal knows of your arrest," I said. "Knows of it?" very stupidly. "My superiors act, of course, by order of the 33. You will now undergo interrogation." The guards caught my arms. I resisted them, saying angrily, "I'm willing to answer what you ask. You can leave out the intimidation." The thin-faced man paid no attention, but called back another guard. The three of them got me strapped on a pull-down table, stripped me, and injected me with, I suppose, one of the veridical drugs. I don't know how long the questioning lasted, or what it concerned, as I was drugged more or less heavily all the time and have no memory of it. When I came to myself again, I had no idea how long I had been kept in Kundershaden, 4 or 5 days, judging by my physical condition, but I was not sure. For some while after that, I did not know what day of the month it was, nor what month. And in fact, I came only slowly to comprehend my surroundings at all. I was in a caravan truck, much like the truck that had carried me over the Kargav to Rer, but in the van, not the cab. There were 20 or 30 other people in with me. Hard to tell how many, since there were no windows and light came only through a slit in the rear door, screened with 4 thicknesses of steel mesh. We had evidently been traveling some while, when I recovered conscious thought, as each person's place was more or less defined, and the smell of excreta, vomit, and sweat had already reached a point it neither surpassed nor declined from. No one knew any of the others. No one knew where we were being taken. There was little talking. It was the second time I had been locked in the dark with uncomplaining, unhopeful people of Orgarain. I knew now the sign I had been given my first night in this country. I had ignored that black cellar and gone looking for the substance of Orgarain above ground in daylight. No wonder nothing had seemed real. I felt that the truck was going east and couldn't get rid of this impression even when it became plain that it was going west, farther and farther into Orgarain. One's magnetic and directional substances are all wrong on other planets. When the intellect won't or can't compensate for that wrongness, the result is a profound bewilderment, a feeling that everything literally has come loose. One of the truckload died that night. He had been clubbed or kicked in the abdomen and died, hemorrhaging from anus and mouth. No one did anything for him. There was nothing to be done. A plastic jug of water had been shoved in amongst us some hours before, but it was long since dry. The man happened to be next to me on the right, and I took his head on my knees to give him relief in breathing, so he died. We were all naked, but thereafter I wore his blood for clothing on my legs and thighs and hands, a dry, stiff, brown garment with no warmth in it. The night grew bitter, and we had to get close together for warmth. The corpse, having nothing to give, was pushed out of the group, excluded. The rest of us huddled together, swaying and jolting all in one motion all night. Darkness was total inside our steel box. We were on some country road, and no truck followed us. Even with face pressed up close to the mesh, one could see nothing out the door slit but darkness and the vague loom of fallen snow. Falling snow, new fallen snow, long fallen snow, snow after rain has fallen on it, refrozen snow. Orgota and Karhaidish have a word for each of these. In Karhaidish, which I know better than Orgota, they have, by my count, 62 words for the various kinds, states, ages, and qualities of snow. Fallen snow, that is. There is another set of words for the varieties of snowfall, another for ice, a set of 20 or more that define what the temperature range is, how strong a wind blows, and what kind of precipitation is occurring altogether. I sat and tried to draw up lists of these words in my head that night. Each time I recalled another one, I would repeat the lists, inserting it in its alphabetical place. Along after dawn, the truck stopped. People screamed out the slit that there was a dead body in the truck. Come and take it out. One after another of us screamed and shouted. We pounded together on the sides and door, making so hideous a pandemonium inside the steel box that we could not stand it ourselves. No one came. The truck stood still for some hours. At last there was a sound of voices outside. The truck lurched, skidding on an ice patch, and set off again. One could see through the slit that it was late on a sunny morning, and that we were going through wooded hills. The truck continued thus for 3 more days and nights, 4 in all since my awakening. It made no stops at inspection points, and I think it never passed through a town of any size. Its journey was erratic, furtive. There were stops to change drivers and recharge batteries. There were other longer stops for no reason that could be discerned from inside the van. 2 of the days it sat still from noon till dark, as if deserted, then began its run again at night. Once a day, around noon, a big jug of water was passed in through a trap in the door. Counting the corpse, there were 26 of us. 2 13s. Githinians often think in 13s, 26s, 52s, no doubt because of the 26-day lunar cycle that makes their unvarying month and approximates their sexual cycle. The corpse was shoved up tight against the steel doors that formed the rear wall of our box, where he would keep cold. The rest of us sat and lay crouched, each in his own place, his territory, his domain, until night, when the cold grew so extreme that little by little we drew together and merged into one entity occupying one space, warm in the middle, cold at the periphery. There was kindness. I and certain others, an old man and one with a bad cough, were recognized as being least resistant to the cold, and each night we were at the center of the group, the entity of 25 where it was warmest. We did not struggle for the warm place, we simply were in it each night. It is a terrible thing, this kindness that human beings do not lose. Terrible because when we are finally naked in the dark and cold, it is all we have. We who are so rich, so full of strength, we end up with that small change. We have nothing else to give. Despite our crowdedness and our huddling together nights, we in the truck were remote from one another. Some were stupefied from drugging, some were probably mental or social defectives to start with, all were abused and scared. Yet it may be strange that among 25 not one ever spoke to all the others together, not even to curse them. Kindness there was, and endurance, but in silence, always in silence, jammed together in the sour darkness of our shared mortality. We bumped one another continually, jolted together, fell over one another, breathed our breaths mingling, laid the heat of our bodies together as a fire is laid, but remained strangers. and never learned the name of any of them in the truck. One day, the third day, I think, when the truck stopped still for hours, and I wondered if they had simply left us in some desert place to rot, one of them began to talk to me. He kept telling me a long story about a mill in South Ogorain where he had worked, and how he had got into trouble with an overseer. He talked and talked in his soft, dull voice, and kept putting his hand on mine as if to be sure he had my attention. The sun was getting west of us, and as we stood slewed around on the shoulder of the road, a shaft of light entered in the window slit. Suddenly, even back in the box, one could see. I saw a girl, a filthy, pretty, stupid, weary girl looking up into my face as she talked, smiling timidly, looking for solace. The young Orgota was in Kemmer, and had been drawn to me. The one time any one of them asked anything of me, and I couldn't give it. I got up and went to the window slit as if for air and a look out, and did not come back to my place for a long time. That night the truck went up long grades, down, up again. From time to time it halted inexplicably. At each halt, a frozen, unbroken silence lay outside the steel walls of our box. The silence of vast wastelands, of the heights. The one in Kemmer still kept the place beside mine and still sought to touch me. I stood up for a long time again with my face pressed to the steel mesh of the window, breathing clean air that cut my throat and lungs like a razor. My hands pressed against the metal door became numb. I realized at last that they were or soon would be frostbitten. My breath had made a little ice bridge between my lips and the mesh. I had to break this bridge with my fingers before I could turn away. When I huddled down with the others, I began to shake with cold, a kind of shaking I had not experienced, jumping, racking spasms like the convulsions of fever. The truck started up again. Noise and motion gave an illusion of warmth, dispelling that utter glacial silence. But I was still too cold to sleep that night. I thought we were at a fairly high altitude most of the night, but it was hard to tell, one's breathing, heartbeat, and energy level being unreliable indicators given the circumstances. As I knew later, we were crossing the Sembensians that night, and must have gone up over 9,000 feet on the passes. I was not much troubled by hunger. The last meal I remembered eating was that long and heavy dinner in Shuskis's house. They must have fed me in Kundershaden, but I had no recollection of it. Eating did not seem to be a part of this existence in the steel box, and I did not often think about it. Thirst, on the other hand, was one of the permanent conditions of life. Once daily, at a stop, the trap, evidently set into the rear door for this purpose, was unbolted. One of us thrust out the plastic jug, and it was soon thrust back in, filled, along with a brief gust of icy air. There was no way to measure out the water among us. The jug was passed, and each got 3 or 4 good swallows before the next hand reached for it. No one person or group acted as dispensers or guardians. None saw to it that a drink was saved for the man who coughed, though he was now in a high fever. I suggested this once, and those around me nodded, but it was not done. The water was shared more or less equally. No one ever tried to get much more than his share, and was gone within a few minutes. Once the last three, up against the forward wall of the box, got none, the jug being dry when it came to them. The next day, two of them insisted on being first in line, and were. The third lay huddled in his front corner, unstirring, and nobody saw to it that he got his share. Why didn't I try to? I don't know. That was the fourth day in the truck. If I had been passed over, I'm not sure I would have made an effort to get my share. I was aware of his thirst and his suffering, and the sick man's, and the others, much as I was aware of my own. I was unable to do anything about any of this suffering, and therefore accepted it, as they did, placidly. I know that people might behave very differently in the same circumstances.
These were Orgota, people trained from birth in a discipline of cooperation, obedience, submission to a group purpose ordered from above. The qualities of independence and decision were weakened in them. They had not much capacity for anger. They formed a whole, I among them. Each felt it, and it was a refuge and true comfort in the night. That wholeness of the huddled group, each drawing life from the others. But there was no spokesman for the whole. It was headless, passive. Men whose will was tempered to a sharper edge might have done much better, talked more, shared the water more justly, given more ease to the sick, and kept their courage higher. I don't know. I only know what it was like inside that truck. On the fifth morning, if my count is right, from the day I wakened in the truck, it stopped. We heard talking outside and calling back and forth. The steel rear doors were unbolted from the outside and flung wide open. One by one we crept to that open end of the steel box, some on hands and knees, and jumped or crawled down onto the ground. 24 of us did. 2 dead men, the old corpse, and a new one, the one who had not got his drink of water for 2 days, were dragged out. It was cold outside. So cold and so glaring with white sunlight and white snow that to leave the fetid shelter of the truck was very hard. And some of us wept. We stood bunched up beside the great truck, all of us naked and stinking, our little hole, our night entity exposed to the bright, cruel daylight. They broke us up, made us form a line, and led us towards a building a few hundred yards away. The metal walls and snow-covered roof of the building, the plain of snow all around, the great range of mountains that lay under the rising sun, the vast sky, all seemed to shake and glitter with excess of light. We were lined up to wash ourselves at a big trough in a frame hut. Everybody began by drinking the wash water. After that we were led into the main building and given undershirts, gray felt shirts, breeches, leggings, and felt boots. A guard checked off our names on a list as we filed into the refectory, where with 100 or more other people in gray we sat at bolted-down tables and were served breakfast, grain porridge, and beer. After that, the whole lot of us, new prisoners and old, were divided up into squads of 12. My squad was taken to a sawmill a few hundred yards behind the main building, inside the fence. Outside the fence, and not far from it, a forest began that covered the folded hills as far to northward as the eye could see. Under the direction of our guard, we carried and stacked sawn boards from the mill to a huge shed where lumber was stored through the winter. It was not easy to walk, stoop, and lift loads after the days in the truck. They didn't let us stand idle, but they didn't force the pace either. In the middle of the day, we were served a cupful of the unfermented grain brew, Orsch. Before sunset, we were taken back to the barracks and given dinner, porridge with some vegetables, and beer. By nightfall, we were locked into the dormitory, which was kept fully lighted all night. We slept on 5-foot-deep shelves all around the walls of the room in 2 tiers. Old prisoners scrambled for the upper tier, the more desirable since heat rises. For bedding, each man was issued a sleeping bag at the door. They were coarse, heavy bags, foul with other men's sweat, but well insulated and warm. Their drawback for me was their shortness. An average-sized Gathenian could get clear inside, head and all, but I couldn't. Nor could I ever stretch out fully on the sleeping shelf. The place was called Pulefin Commensality, 3rd Voluntary Farm and Resettlement Agency. Pulefin, District 30, is in the extreme northwest of the habitable zone of Ogorin, bounded by the Sembensian Mountains, the Esagal River, and the coast. The area is thinly settled without big cities. The town nearest us was a place called Turuf, several miles to the southwest. I never saw it. The farm was on the edge of a great unpopulated forest region, Tarenpeth. Too far north for the larger trees, Hemin or Serim or Black Vate, the forest was all of one kind of tree, a gnarled, scrubby conifer 10 or 12 feet high, gray-needled, called Thor. Though the number of native species, plant or animal, on Winter is unusually small, the membership of each species is very large. There were thousands of square miles of thor trees, and nothing much else in that forest. Even the wilderness is carefully husbanded there, and though that forest had been logged for centuries, there were no waste places in it, no desolations of stumps, no eroded slopes. It seemed that every tree in it was accounted for, and that not one grain of sawdust from our mill went unused. There was a small plant on the farm, and when the weather prevented parties from going out into the forest, we worked in the mill or in the plant, treating and compressing chips, bark, and sawdust into various forms, and extracting from the dried thorn needles a resin used in plastics. The work was genuine work, and we were not overdriven. If they had allowed a little more food and better clothing, much of the work would have been pleasant. But we were too hungry and cold most of the time for any pleasure. The guards were seldom harsh and never cruel. They tended to be stolid, slovenly, heavy, and to my eyes, effeminate. Not in the sense of delicacy, etc., but in just the opposite sense, a gross, bland fleshiness, a bovinity without point or edge. Among my fellow prisoners, I had also, for the first time on Winter, a certain feeling of being a man among women, or among eunuchs. The prisoners had that same flabbiness and coarseness. They were hard to tell apart. Their emotional tone seemed always low, their talk trivial. I took this lifelessness and leveling at first for the effect of the privation of food, warmth, and liberty. But I soon found out that it was more specific an effect than that. It was the result of the drugs given all prisoners to keep them out of Kemmer. I knew that drugs existed that could reduce or virtually eliminate the potency phase of the Gathenial sexual cycle. They were used when convenience, medicine, or morality dictated abstinence. One Kemmer or several could be skipped, thus without ill effect. The voluntary use of such drugs was common and accepted. It had not occurred to me that they might be administered to unwilling persons. There were good reasons. A prisoner in Kemmer would be a disruptive element in his work squad. If let off work, what was to be done with him? Especially if no other prisoner was in Kemmer at the time, as was possible, there being only some 150 of us. To go through Kemmer without a partner is pretty hard on a Gathenian. Better than simply obviate the misery and wasted work time and not go through Kemmer at all. So they prevented it. Prisoners who had been there for several years were psychologically and, I believe, to some extent, physically adapted to this chemical castration. They were as sexless as steers. They were without shame and without desire, like the angels. But it is not human to be without shame and without desire. Being so strictly defined and limited by nature, the sexual urge of Gathenians is really not much interfered with by society. There is less coding, channeling, and repressing of sex there than in any bisexual society I know of. Abstinence is entirely voluntary. Indulgence is entirely acceptable. Sexual fear and sexual frustration are both extremely rare. This was the first case I had seen of the social purpose running counter to the sexual drive. Being a suppression, not merely a repression, it produced not frustration, but something more ominous, perhaps, in the long run. Passivity. There are no communal insects on Winter. Gathenians do not share their earth as Terrans do with those older societies, those innumerable cities of little sexless workers, possessing no instinct but that of obedience to the group, the whole. If there were ants on Winter, Gathenians might have tried to imitate them long ago. The regime of the voluntary farms is a fairly recent thing, limited to one country of the planet and literally unknown elsewhere. But it is an ominous sign of the direction that a society of people so vulnerable to sexual control might take. At Puleffin Farm we were, as I said, underfed for the work we did, and our clothing, particularly our footgear, was completely inadequate for that winter climate. The guards, most of them probationary prisoners, were not much better off. The intent of the place and its regime was punitive, but not destructive,
and I think it might have been endurable without the druggings and the examinations. Some of the prisoners underwent the examination in groups of 12. They merely recited a sort of confessional and catechism, got their anti-chemo shot, and were released to work. Others, the political prisoners, were subjected every fifth day to questioning under drugs. I don't know what drugs they used. I don't know the purpose of the questioning. I have no idea what questions they asked me. I would come to myself in the dormitory after a few hours, laid out on the sleeping shelf with 6 or 7 others, some waking like myself, some still slack and blank in the grip of the drug. When we were all afoot, the guards would take us out to the plant to work, but after the 3rd or 4th of these examinations, I was unable to get up. They let me be, and next day I could go out with my squad, though I felt shaky. After the next examination, I was helpless for 2 days. Either the anti-chemer hormones or the veridicals evidently had a toxic effect on my non-Gathenian nervous system, and the effect was cumulative. I remember planning how I would plead with the inspector when the next examination came. I would start by promising to answer truthfully anything he asked, without drugs, and later I would say to him, "Sir, don't you see how useless it is to know the answer to the wrong question?" Then the inspector would turn into Faxe with the foreteller's gold chain around his neck, and I would have long conversations with Faxe very pleasantly, while I controlled the drip of acid from a tube into a vat of pulverized wood chips. Of course, when I came to the little room where they examined us, the inspector's aide had pulled back my collar and given me the injection before I could speak. And all I remember from that session, or perhaps the memory is from an earlier one, is the inspector, a tired-looking young Orgota with dirty fingernails, saying drearily, "You must answer my questions in Orgota. You must not speak any other language. You must speak in Orgota." There was no infirmary. The principle of the farm was work or die. But there were leniencies in practice, gaps between work and death, provided by the guards. As I said, they were not cruel, neither were they kind. They were slipshod and didn't much care so long as they kept out of trouble themselves. They let me and another prisoner stay in the dormitory, simply left us there in our sleeping bags as if by oversight, when it was plain that we could not stand up on our feet. I was extremely ill after the last examination. The other, a middle-aged fellow, had some disorder or disease of the kidney and was dying. As he could not die all at once, he was allowed to spend some time at it, on the sleeping shelf. I remember him more clearly than anything else in Puleffin Farm. He was physically a typical Gathenian of the great continent, compactly made, short-legged and short-armed, with a solid layer of subcutaneous fat giving him, even in illness, a sleek roundness of body. He had small feet and hands, rather broad hips, and a deep chest, the breasts scarcely more developed than in a male of my race. His skin was dark, ruddy brown, his black hair fine and fur-like. His face was broad, with small, strong features, the cheekbones pronounced. It is a type not unlike that of various isolated Terran groups living in very high altitudes or Arctic areas. His name was Asra. He had been a carpenter. We talked. Asra was not, I think, unwilling to die, but he was afraid of dying. He sought distraction from his fear. We had little in common, other than our nearness to death, and that was not what we wanted to talk about, so much of the time we did not understand each other very well. It did not matter to him. I, younger and incredulous, would have liked understanding, comprehension, explanation. But there was no explanation. We talked. At night the barracks dormitory was glaring, crowded and noisy. During the day the lights were turned off and the big room was dusky, empty, still. We lay close together on the sleeping shelf and talked softly. Asra liked best to tell long, meandering tales about his young days on a commensal farm in the Kundera Valley, that broad, splendid plain I had driven through coming from the border to Mishnori. His dialect was strong,
and he used many names of people, places, customs, tools, that I did not know the meaning of, so I seldom caught more than the drift of his reminiscences. When he was feeling easiest, usually around noon, I would ask him for a myth or tale. Most Athenians are well stuffed with these. Their literature, though it exists in written form, is a live oral tradition, and they are all, in this sense, literate. Asar knew the Orgota staples, the short tales of Mesha, the tale of Parsid, parts of the great epics, and the novel-like Sea Trader's Saga. These, and bits of local lore recalled from his childhood, he would tell in his soft, slurry dialect, and then, growing tired, would ask me for a story. "What do they tell in Garhide?" he would say, rubbing his legs, which tormented him with aches and shooting pains, and turning to me, his face with its shy, sly, patient smile. Once I said, "I know a story about people who live on another world."
"What kind of world would that be?"
"One like this one, all in all. But it doesn't go around the sun. It goes around the star you call Selene. It's a yellow star like the sun, and on that world, under that sun, live other people."
"That's in the Sanavi teachings, that about the other worlds. There used to be an old Sanavi crazy priest would come by my hearth when I was little and tell us children all about that, where the liars go when they die, and where the suicides go, and where the thieves go. That's where we're going, me and you, eh? One of those places?"
"No. This I'm telling of isn't a spirit world, a real one. The people that live on it are real people, alive, just like here. But very long ago they learned how to fly." Asra grinned. "Not by flapping their arms, you know. They flew in machines, like cars." But it was hard to say in Orgota, which lacks a word meaning precisely to fly. The closest one can come has more the meaning of glide. "Well, they learned how to make machines that went right over the air as a sledge goes over snow. And after a while they learned how to make them go farther and faster, till they went like the stone out of a sling off the earth and over the clouds and out of the air, clear to another world, going around another sun. And when they got to that world, what did they find there but men sliding in the air? Maybe, maybe not. When they got to my world, we already knew how to get about in the air. But they taught us how to get from world to world. We didn't yet have the machines for that." Asar was puzzled by the injection of the teller into the tale. "I was feverish, bothered by the sores that the drugs had brought out on my arms and chest, and I could not remember how I had meant to weave the story."
"Go on," he said, trying to make sense of it. "What did they do besides go in the air?"
"Oh, they did much as people do here. But they're all in Kemmer all the time." He chuckled. "There was, of course, no chance of concealment in this life. And my nickname among prisoners and guards was inevitably the pervert. But where there is no desire and no shame, no one, however anomalous, is singled out. And I think Asra made no connection of this notion with myself and my peculiarities. He saw it merely as a variation on an old theme, and so he chuckled a little and said,
'In camera all the time. Is it a place of reward, then? Or a place of punishment?'
'I don't know, Asra. Which is this world?'
'Neither, child. This here is just the world. It's how it is. You get born into it, and things are as they are.'
'I wasn't born into it. I came to it. I chose it.' The silence and the shadow hung around us. Away off in the country silence, beyond the barracks walls, there was one tiny edge of sound, a handsaw keening. Nothing else.
"Ah, well. Ah, well,"
Asra murmured, and sighed, and rubbed his legs,
making a little moaning sound that he was not aware of himself.
"We none of us choose," he said.
A night or two after that he went into a coma, and presently died. I had not learned what he'd been sent to the voluntary farm for, what crime or fault or irregularity in his identification papers. I knew only that he had been in Puleffin Farm less than a year. The day after Astra's death, they called me for examination. This time they had to carry me in. And I can't remember anything further than that.
Chapter 14. The Escape. When Opsla and Yege both left town, and Slosa's doorkeeper refused me entrance, I knew it was time to turn to my enemies, but there was no more good in my friends. I went to Commissioner Shuskis and blackmailed him. Lacking sufficient cash to buy him with, I had to spend my reputation. Among the perfidious, the name of traitor is capital in itself. I told him that I was in Orgorain as agent of the nobles' faction in Karhide, which was planning the assassination of Tybe, and that he had been designated as my Sarf contact. If he refused to give me the information I needed, I would tell my friends in Erenrang that he was a double agent, serving the open trade faction, and this word would of course get back to Mishnori and to the Sarf. And the damned fool, believe me. He told me quick enough what I wanted to know. He even asked me if I approved. I was not in immediate danger from my friends, Opsla, Yege, and the others. They had bought their safety by sacrificing the envoy, and trusted me to make no trouble for them or myself. Until I went to Shuskis, no one in the Sarf but Gaum had considered me worthy of their notice. But now they would be hard at my heels. I must finish my business and drop out of sight. Having no way to get word directly to anyone in Karhide, as mail would be read and telephone or radio listened to, I went for the first time to the Royal Embassy. Sardan Remir Chenowich, whom I had known well at court, was on the staff there. He agreed at once to convey to Argaven a message stating what had become of the envoy and where he was to be imprisoned. I could trust Chenowich, a clever and honest person, to get the message through unintercepted, though what Argaven would make of it, or do with it, I could not guess. I wanted Argaven to have that information in case I's starship did come suddenly falling down out of the clouds, for at that time I still kept some hope that he had signaled the ship before the Sarf arrested him. I was now in peril, and if I had been seen to enter the embassy, in instant peril. I went straight from its door to the caravan port on the south side, and before noon of that day, Otsreth Susmi, I left Mishnori as I had entered it, as carry-loader on a truck. I had my old permits with me, a little altered, to fit the new job. Forgery of papers is risky in Orgorain, where they are inspected 52 times daily. But it is not rare for being risky, and my old companions in Fish Island had shown me the tricks of it. To wear a false name galls me, but nothing else would save me, or get me clear across the width of Orgorain to the coast of the Western Sea. My thoughts were all there in the west as the caravan went rumbling across the Kundera Bridge and out of Mishnori. Autumn was facing towards winter now, and I must get to my destination before the roads closed to fast traffic, and while there was still some good in getting there. I had seen a voluntary farm over in Komsvashom when I was in the Sinoth administration, and had talked with ex-prisoners of farms. What I had seen and heard lay heavy on me now. The envoy, so vulnerable to cold that he wore a coat when the weather was in the 30s, would not survive winter in Puleffin. Thus need drove me fast, but the caravan took me slow, weaving from town to town northward and southward of the way, loading and unloading so that it took me a half month to get to Ethwen, at the mouth of the river Hesagel. In Ethwen I had luck. Talking with men in the transient house, I heard of the fur trade up the river, how licensed trappers went up and down river by sledge or ice boat through Taranpeth forest almost to the ice. Out of their talk of traps came my plan of trap springing. There are white fur pestry in Kermland as in the Gobrin hinterlands. They like places that lie under the breath of the glacier. I had hunted them when I was young in the Thor forests of Kerm. Why not go trapping them now in the Thor forests of Puleffin? In that far west and north of Orgorain,
In the great wild lands west of the Sembensian, men come and go somewhat as they like, but there are not enough inspectors to keep them all penned in. Something of the old freedom survives the new epoch there. Ethway